Bienvenue sur le podcast pour un plein épanouissement affectif et cognitif. Un podcast pour les apprenants, les parents et les profs qui veulent plonger dans la pédagogie Montessori et les neurosciences. Avant d'écouter ce nouvel épisode, j'ai trois propositions à vous faire. Si vous êtes parent d'un enfant au collège et que vous avez à cœur son plein épanouissement, vous pouvez télécharger gratuitement sur mon blog le PDF « Le cerveau des adolescents est littéralement génial ». Si vous avez des enfants ou des élèves entre 7 et 12 ans, vous pourrez découvrir « Je mémorise la conjugaison », une méthode que j'ai créée pour que la conjugaison redevienne un jeu d'enfant. Pour les profs des écoles qui souhaitent s'engager dans une formation et être soutenus dans leur transition éducative, je vous accompagne lors de la formation Montessori, une pédagogie en cohérence avec le fonctionnement du cerveau. Parents et professeurs des écoles, rendez-vous donc sur mon blog montessori-apprendreautrement.com. Je suis Céline Guerrero, prof des écoles, formatrice Montessori, réalisatrice de ce podcast et prête à tout pour que chaque enfant développe son plein potentiel. Si ce podcast vous plaît, je compte sur vous pour laisser un commentaire sur votre plateforme d'écoute et une note de 5 étoiles si vous êtes sur Apple Podcast. C'est la meilleure solution pour donner de la visibilité au podcast et contribuer vous aussi à cette transition éducative. Et partagez les épisodes qui vous plaisent avec vos amis et vos collègues. Pour ce 81e épisode, j'ai eu la chance d'échanger avec Julia Volkmann, une éducatrice Montessori et neuroscientifique qui est aussi professeure à l'université d'Harvard. Julia vit aux États-Unis, au Massachusetts. Elle est la créatrice de Metree Learning, une société qui crée du matériel pédagogique fondé sur la recherche. Julia parle un petit peu français, donc après l'enregistrement, nous avons échangé sur l'apprentissage des langues, un sujet qui me passionne, comme vous le savez sûrement. Et dans cet épisode, nous avons parlé des recherches en neurosciences qui confirment les travaux du docteur Maria Montessori, de flow, de fonction exécutive, enfin bref, tout ce qui permet aux enfants de développer leur plein potentiel. Je laisse place à ma conversation avec Julia. Hello Julia, it's a huge pleasure for me to be talking to you today. Can you introduce yourself and tell us about your daily work?
Sure, it's a great pleasure for me to be here too, Céline. My name is Julia Volkmann, and I run Metree Learning, and that involves making materials for schools around the country and the world, and supporting my team as they make materials. But also it involves working with schools and teachers to improve their practice. I also am a teaching assistant at Harvard University in the Neuroscience of Learning course, and so I'm always trying to keep up to date on the research, which I need to. To be ready to support the work we do in that course. And I like to write, so I'm working on some articles right now and just finished up my albums to support teachers who have already been trained or teachers who are in training. So I'm always doing something.
Okay. And I'm a big proponent of Montessori education, and I'm going to study neuroscience at university this school year.
Yay.
I also took the online course Neuroscience in the Classroom, and I'm really interested in bridging the gaps between the two subjects. Can we say that Montessori education influences the physical architecture of the brain?
Absolutely. You could say that everything we do all day long influences the physical architecture of the brain, because everything, especially everything we do repeatedly, the brain likes to get more efficient at things that we do repeatedly. So our neural networks there are built as a result of genetics and physiology or health and our experience and all of that. And Montessori encourages the whole development of the human, and particularly encourages repetition, which is really great for strengthening your neural networks.
Okay. And I think there is not a lot of research on Montessori and neuroscience. What research supports the Montessori method as far as you know?
So that's a really great question. There is a growing body of research on Montessori in general. Some of it is on neuroscience, but mostly the neuroscience research is not specific to Montessori, although there is a little bit. So I would look to work by Stanislaw Dehaene, specifically your French compadre there. He has done tremendous work on literacy, using mostly fMRI as one of his main techniques to look inside the brain while it's in action. Also, Mary Helen Amordino Yang, she does work out at University of San Diego on social-emotional affective neuroscience. And she and I talk about Montessori and how it fits together with all of her research findings. Also, Solange Denervaux, Another Frenchie, she is doing some work that's really, she just published some things, I think it was last year, on error monitoring. And I know she has some new publications in the pipeline. Then there's Adele Diamond, and then the Center for the Developing Child at Harvard, and also Angeline Little, but that's less specifically for neuroscience, that's more general.
Okay. The first name you said, can you write it down for me after the interview, please?
Sure, happy to.
Thank you. And which pillars in Montessori education are confirmed by neuroscience?
Well, this is a great question, because what are the pillars of Montessori education? That's the first question. Like, there's so many different ways. So I started looking at this, and I'm like, well, what could pillars mean? And it could mean, like, by Angeline Lillard, the way she defines it in her book, she's looking at movement, choice and perceived control, interest, rewards and motivation, peer learning, context-based learning, also teaching styles and general order, right? And then I look to the theory lectures, like if you do your teacher training, right? What kind of theory lectures are you taught? And those are on the planes of development, the human tendencies, the absorbent mind, sensitive periods. So I wanted to know more from you by what you thought were the pillars of Montessori language or Montessori education, and then I would go from there.
Are you asking me to define the pillars? Oh, no, it's too hard.
What do you think they are?
I can do that in French, but in English, I will try. you challenged me. Children can choose their material and activity. They can work. They are not. Adults don't interrupt them. They can work 1 hour, 2 hours on the same material if they want. And the teacher observes the observes children in order to know what they need. Observation and it's so hard. And
and
the material it's really concrete. So in math, we can understand how it works. It's really helpful. When I was a teenager, I didn't understand math at all. And thanks to the material, I can understand how division works, a lot of concepts in math.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you pretty much hit those all right on the head, Céline. Yeah, that was great. And so when you look at each of those topics individually, if you then look into the scientific literature, you can absolutely find support for each one of those topics. And it just, you have to narrow down in on it. But the key things, it's hard to get specific neuroscience support for some of these ideas, because we don't have a machine that can be watching a child's brain while they are making free choice, while they are, you know, experiencing flow, immersed in an activity, you know, while they are seeing logical consequences to their actions. We don't have that kind of technology yet. So we have to infer a lot from other studies, but we are getting closer, I think, to being able to support the pillars. I haven't found anything that contradicts them. Let's say that.
Okay. I love the research of Solange de Nerveau. I interviewed her a few months ago, and so it was great to dive into her research.
Yeah, it's exciting what she's doing.
Yeah. And do you think Maria Montessori was able to understand what was happening in the brain, even without an MRI?
Yes, this is a great question, because I think you hit on it earlier when you said scientific observation and observing the child. And that's really what the Montessori method is. Maria Montessori, Dr. Montessori, she didn't want to call it the Montessori method at all. She wanted to call it scientific pedagogy, because it's based, it's steeped in science. It's all about the scientific method, where you observe and you see what happens, and then you try an intervention, objectively observe, see what happens, adjust your intervention, and you keep going on that based on actual feedback that you're getting, actual evidence that you're collecting through evidence. So that is kind of encouraging for us, because when we look at the child, and while we don't have this portable MRI to stick on their head, we can watch them, and if we've trained ourselves to observe objectively and put our judgment aside and to see what's actually happening, not we expect or fear, right, or hope, right, if we just see what's really going on, that is, I think, what Dr. Montessori was able to do. She was an objective observer, and that's why she could have such accurate results in her findings. But we can all do that. We just have to train ourselves.
And do you think it's possible to do that even if it's not a Montessori school?
Absolutely. The challenges with non-Montessori schools is that in traditional education, the administration or the government is telling you what you need to do with the child. And it's a little difficult to have the flexibility to adapt based on what your observations show if you have this overriding requirement that you have to fit yourselves into. You know, sometimes you're trying to stick a square into a round hole, right? And so it's a little tricky. It is absolutely possible for you to inform your practice, though, in any kind of educational practice by observation and collecting, you know, evaluating the feedback and the evidence that you collect to see what right approaches might be, what changes you could make.
Okay, that's really interesting. And can you confirm that the experience and the environment are both important?
Absolutely. And this is something that can be encouraging and discouraging both at the same time, because biology and experience are really inseparable. It's not just that they go together, it's that you can't, they're interconnected, completely interconnected. Think about if a mother doesn't receive enough folic acid while she's pregnant, right? The baby could be at risk for developing spina bifida because that's required. So that's biology really taking over everything else, right? So the biology says normal development, but the environment says, I need folic acid. And so if the biology says, if I don't get folic acid, I'm going to have this error in neural development, that's what's going to happen. So you can see right there, it's an interplay. Some infants, if they don't get enough folic acid, they're less susceptible because of their genetics, and others are more susceptible. So it's really connected. You can also think of dyslexia this way. Dyslexia is a genetically based condition. And it's so interesting because even if you have it, if you find something that you're strongly interested in and driven to study, you can end up being hugely successful, a Nobel laureate in a reading intensive field. And that's because of the environment and your interest and your drive and motivation to overcome something. It never really gets easy, but you keep going anyway. So that's where, again, genetics and environment are going hand in hand to kind of lay things out. So you might be stuck with genetics that are not what you'd hope for, but you could put a lot of protective factors in place to work to the best of your potential.
Okay, so later in life, we can influence the brain structure, but with effort. And in early life, experience just dramatically influences how the brain changes. That's right?
No. You can change, you can influence the brain anytime, and it can be effortless or effortful. So say your question again, because I'm not sure I fully understand.
Okay, sorry. I think we can influence the brain structure when we are adults, but with effort. When we are a child, it's effortless.
Yes.
And when we are adult, it's effortful.
Full.
Okay.
Yes, yes, exactly. And that's exactly how plasticity works. When you're born, it's kind of, you just exist and all of these things get wired up, you know, so beautifully. And as we get older, we can still completely influence our neural networks, but we have to work harder. We may have to study longer. We may have to repeat more, but it's absolutely possible. We have plasticity available to us at every stage of development from birth or before birth through the end of our life.
I saw a curve, I'm not sure it's the right word, a line, a curve on plasticity. And we can see it's harder when we are older.
Yes, it takes more effort when we're older, but we still have it. So
yeah.
Don't give up.
No. I don't give up. I've been learning English for 16 months, so I don't give up.
You're doing great. Oh my gosh.
And from birth to age 6. Montessori talked about an absorbent mind period. Is that when the brain effortlessly changes?
Yes. So yes, it does. And we are biologically programmed to learn a whole lot without ever trying, right? Because we're driven internally. And that's what she was talking about, sensitive periods and human tendencies that drive us. No one teaches the child how to walk or speak. They teach themselves, yet these are enormous accomplishments. And that's that early effortless plasticity. We call this, actually, the younger child is a special type of plasticity called experience-dependent plasticity. And this means they actually have to interact with the world to invoke and trigger certain things that need to happen neurologically. And so like if they don't get enough visual experience, they will form weaker networks for vision. If they don't get enough, same thing with auditory experience, you actually need auditory experience to lay down the myelin in your auditory cortex. So that's all, experience is really important. So you can't say you just, you know, lie there and you don't have to do anything and then boom, the brain develops. Even as an infant, there has to be environmental, there has to be experience, interaction with humans, interaction with the environment for things to really develop optimally.
Okay, I get it. And Maria Montessori said, the mind is made by the work of hands. That's not her only quotation, but maybe it's one of the most important ones, right?
It's a very important one. I love it. I just want to clarify that the hands aren't actually required. If you lose your hands, if you're born without hands, you know, maybe it'll be your feet, but you can still, you know, maybe it'll be the rest of your body if you have feet. So it's not just the hands, but yes, it is through our activity and our how we exert ourselves upon the world that really strongly influences our networks.
Okay. And what are the links between sensitive periods and plasticity?
Okay, so plasticity is the capacity of the brain to change. The sensitive period is a time during the first plane of development, birth to age 6 around, that's not set in stone, when there's an optimal moment where the child is particularly susceptible to certain environmental stimuli. So they have heightened plasticity for certain things, and that's like what I just mentioned about the visual development or the auditory cortex development. So you might see, I remember when my daughter was 3 weeks old, it was Thanksgiving and my whole family was over and we were all like, oh, the baby. And for the first time, it's like she saw her fingers, right? And she was all like, wow, look at my fingers. And everyone in the family was like, oh, she found her fingers. And so that was like so exciting, right? But that is like a sensitive period for sensory development. So she was developing her sensory system and that was where all of her attention was at that moment.
Okay. And is there a critical period for the ability for our ears to distinguish different sounds in languages?
So there is some evidence to support that work from Patricia Cole's lab. And they found that between the ages of 6 and 12 months, infants raised in a Japanese language environment had a decreased affinity for distinguishing the L and R sounds. In Japanese, there is no L and R sound, right? And so in English, those sounds are in English, but not in Japanese. So before that age, it seemed like the infants could hear those sounds as well as children who were raised in an English speaking environment. So it didn't matter before that age, you could hear them. After that age, it seems like our auditory cortex starts to and our language network starts to specialize so that it can hear the most clearly the sounds that are in our language. And again, this is experience dependent. It depends on the language that you're exposed to and being exposed. But overall, I would say that scientists are not really in consensus about what a critical period is, if there really are critical periods. There's a lot that's a hot area for research, and people want to be able to open those critical periods back up. Maybe they can. There's some animal research that's, you know, optimistic in that area. But so a sensitive period and a critical period are different things. And it's not sure that critical periods, the door totally closes. I think it's still open a little bit. You just may not be able to achieve quite as high as you could have if you'd met the critical period. It depends on what you're looking at.
Okay. And we often hear use it or lose it. What does that mean in Montessori terms and in neuroscience terms?
Okay. That's a great question. So Montessori terms, the child needs to be actively engaging in their environment. It's not a passive experience. And neuroscience terms, it's the same thing. Whatever we do repeatedly, the brain gets more efficient at doing, right? And connections that are underused are pruned away, just like we prune away the branches in an apple tree so that the ones that are left are stronger and bear more fruit. It's this process of growing new connections and pruning underused ones. It helps create really strong and efficient networks in our brain. So being actively engaged in learning is really essential.
Thanks. And what is the difference between optimal level and functional level?
So you're talking about Professor Kurt Fischer, who is one of my professors, the late Kurt Fischer at Harvard. His dynamic skill theory is what you're talking about. And his research found that humans are always constructing and deconstructing our knowledge. And then we reconstruct it, and then it deconstructs, falls apart, reconstruct it, falls apart, and then reconstruct it until we kind of reach this mastery level where we don't have to go through that process anymore. And this, what's really interesting is that these progressions where we're constructing and these regressions where we're deconstructing are predictable. The regressions are just as predictable as the progressions. So as teachers in the classroom, we have to not be totally discouraged. If the, you know, we're like, oh, we did this work yesterday, and the next child that comes in and they're like, I don't know what I'm doing, right? You're like, we just did that. It's okay. And how we help them move past that to reconstruct it is through scaffolds. We support them. You know, we support them by maybe giving them another presentation, maybe having them work with another child on the material, or encouraging them to watch another child do the work. There are many scaffolds that we can import. We give them hints. Like, we don't, that's why we don't want kids to fail, right? We're just like, don't ask them for something that you don't think they're actually going to succeed with. We give them little hints all the time to help with that. That's the scaffold that we do to support. And that will help them reach their optimal level, whereas if you're on a standardized test, you may only see this lower functional level, the level you can do without any support, right? Mm. So we have this optimal level is what we're actually going up and down and constructing and reconstructing, deconstructing, reconstructing. But that is assuming that we get scaffolds to help us to buoy our efforts and bring us up higher. Whereas the functional level is what we can do if we absolutely have zero support at all in those scaffolds.
I'm wondering, when you said deconstruct, is it connected with forgetfulness? It's normal to forget and we need to reconstruct, to forget, to reconstruct?
That's a great observation. In memory, it is normal to forget, and it's actually necessary to forget. It's part of the memory consolidation process. And when we take memories out, we actually reconstruct them a little bit. It's not like we're just watching a video again. We take them out, and then our brain does a little thing. So we should always be respectful of people who can't remember, or for people who are convinced that it happened a different way from you, from how you remember it. We should be very patient with that, because we both may be right. Okay, because memory is actually not just a video, right? It's we're all interacting. But yes, it's deconstructing, reconstructing all the time.
Okay. And can you confirm that a little stress is good?
Yes. So stress is something like COVID, right? We're all like, stress, right? It's so difficult. It's so difficult. And a little stress, that's kind of toxic stress, that environment where you're always like, oh my gosh, it's happening all the time. That's bad for the brain, very bad for the brain. A little stress is called eustress. And that's when you're getting just enough kind of a push or a challenge to make it a little bit hard, but possible, right? So think about when you go to the gym, right? If you're like doing too much weightlifting, you totally trash your, you tear a muscle, right? You get injured. But if you do too little, you don't get strong, right? You need just enough of a challenge to flex your muscles, to flex your brain, make your neural networks work just enough. And then next day, a little more, a little more, a little more. So yeah, it's really helpful.
And I heard about flow. When we are completely absorbed in an activity and we perceive nothing else, can you give us some details about it? And is it something we can see in a Montessori classroom?
Yeah, we see flow all the time in Montessori classrooms. Whenever the child is really completely absorbed, flow is complete absorption in an activity that requires intense concentration. So it's not like when you're absorbed and watching a movie, that doesn't require you to concentrate, right? It's when you're absorbed in something that requires all of your attention, right? And so you don't even notice. You have to go to the bathroom. You don't even notice because you're like, oh, I'm doing all this stuff. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, I just got to go, right? It's like it catches up with you because you're completely oblivious to it. It's the confluence of challenge and skill, arousal and control, right? It's that perfect level of eustress, as it were, just enough interest and just enough challenge. You can manage it, but you have to work at it and really focus on it. Brains love flow. It is very rewarding for the brain. And you can see it when a child ignores what other kids are doing around him and just works on intensely on what the child is doing, right? Completely, whatever's happening. And I've seen this, I know in my class we had it, when the end of the year we would always scrub the chairs. You know, usually we're scrubbing tables and things early in the year, scrubbing the shelves. But the end of the year we'd also scrub the chairs. Oh my God. I have almost every year, there's at least one child who is just completely obsessed with chair scrubbing. And they start scrubbing. The whole day disappears. The other kids are out at recess, and they're like, I'm just scrubbing all the chairs in the classroom. So you can see it all the time in Montessori.
I think it happened to me once to be completely absorbed when I wrote a PDF for how the brain works. It was a PDF for teenagers. And I wrote this PDF maybe in 6 or 7 hours, in a row, and I was completely absorbed. I think it was flow, and it was enjoyable.
It sounds like it was. And when you come out of that state, you're really like, ah, you feel good. Yeah. You know, I mean, you realize that you haven't had anything to drink, you know, but you're like, you feel really good, and the brain is happy. It's really happy. Yeah, that's cool. A lot of people get it when they play instruments. Mm. They'll be totally focused.
And do you remember once when you were completely absorbed? Can you remember one moment?
Yeah, so it actually happens to me sometimes after meditation. I'm a meditation practitioner and have been for decades. And sometimes the process of meditation will bring me there. And sometimes I am a musician, so when I'm playing music, I can also have that experience.
Oh, great. And I heard you say in a YouTube video that attention is intertwined with executive functions. What does that mean?
So, a great question. So, attention, there are three main attention networks, right? There's the alerting network, and that's kind of where you're like, oh, wait, is that something I need to pay attention to, right? The orientation network is then where you put your focus on it. Alerting is just like something's happening. Orienting is like, okay, what's going on? And then executive is like, do I need to actually put my attention on that, right? So the executive part of attention, the ability to decide where to put and maintain our attention, is inherently an executive function because it requires decision-making. It requires saliency to notice what's actually happening. It requires inhibitory control to overlook what's not relevant. And then it requires self-regulation to maintain our focus. So there's this great research on mindfulness and what happens when you're doing a meditation practice where you turn your attention, say you're focused on the breath. That is where your executive network says, okay, this is where I'm going to attend. And then at some point your mind wanders and your default mode network has been active. And then at some point you realize that your mind has wandered. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm thinking. And that's your saliency network, right? And then you decide, okay, I have to put my attention back on the breath. And that's, again, your executive network. So it's like push-ups for the brain, right? You can see where you use all these different networks. They're on and off and on and off and on and off. And that's how it's connected. And that's why mindfulness is such a great way to train attention.
Oh, what an interesting explanation.
Yeah.
And sorry, I lost my next question. I find it. At what age does executive function develop the most?
So that is usually from birth till around age 6, you know, assuming that the environment is supportive. Birth till around age 6, there's this huge rise in executive function capacity. At this age, we're looking at inhibitory control, cognitive flexibility, and working memory. Those are the three foundational aspects of executive function at that age. And then they branch out into larger decision-making, self-regulation as we get older. Hmm.
And we already talked about it when we talked about the pillars of Montessori education. But what is it about a Montessori classroom that enables children to develop their executive functions?
The necessity of making choices all the time. They're choosing where to put their attention, if they can sustain their attention. Because the children are all working on different things, right? They're not all doing the same thing. So they have to decide to maintain their attention here, right, on what they're doing and focus. And that's something they're exercising all the time, like that process I just described. They're constantly getting opportunities to flex those different networks. And so they strengthen them through this repetitive thing of choice and deciding how long to work on something and how to get it done. It's logical consequences and repetition. And because we're aiding children in their independence. We're not doing things for them. We're showing them how to do things for themselves. And as you're independent, you are required to use your brain in these more advanced ways.
And they have to work at their own pace.
Yes, exactly. Because some will be able to go zoom, 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 and some that takes a long time. And we don't know what's happening in the brain. We just have to respect that process. They may come out of that and then boom. I had one student who was not, he was with me for 3 years and it's his third year and he still couldn't read phonetically. Now I knew we had done everything, right? So I'm like, started to worry about it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, halfway through his third year, it all clicked in and he came to it. He was doing all tons of work. All he cared about was animals. And so we just had these field guides, you know, where he was like writing, copying down animal things. He wanted to do that and writing stories about animals phonetically using the alphabet. All of a sudden it came together. And so we can't tell when each child is going to get to a certain place. We just have to keep supporting them, keep scaffolding and keep guiding them in that skillful direction.
And the fact that all the work is self-correcting, is it good for executive functions?
Absolutely. That absolutely, because then you notice yourself. When we have somebody else tell us we did something wrong, if it's an authority figure, that can trigger a little acute stress response, right? And when we have an acute stress response, our activity actually leaves, you know, not completely, but moves away from the frontal part of our cortex and into our emotional limbic area, right? And so we physically lose the capacity to think in these more complex ways because we're limiting our brain access during acute stress. And correction can cause little acute stress responses. We don't even notice it because it's so common in our culture, right? Correct, 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 correct. And so we don't notice it or think anything of it, but it's actually happening. And so we want to remove that correction from the child, because when it comes internally, when you notice your own mistake, or when your friend says to you, hey, what are you doing? It's no problem. There's no stress response. You're like, oh, wait, you're right. And it makes sense. Or you figured out and you're like, oh, wait, I did that wrong. And it's fine. There's no stress. It's just effective in teaching you and helping you figure out what's going on so that you can improve yourself next time.
Okay. And I have a question for you. Juliette, my daughter, who is nearly 10 years old, has a motor disability and she has a wheelchair, but she can walk with canes. She can move as much as the other children. And I know that movement is essential. How can I help her to develop her executive functions?
Well, this is a really personal question for me because I also have a wheelchair that I am required to use sometimes. So I have a lot of experience being in that position. So I would say, remember our directive from the child is to help me to do it by myself. So whatever we want to do, we want to support the human in independence, prepare the environment so that she can be as independent as possible. If there are complex tasks that are really difficult for her to do, break them down into the component parts, just like we do in the classroom. We call them preliminary exercises. And break them down into the smaller parts. So we'll teach them just how to pour before we teach them how to scrub a table, because pouring is part of scrubbing a table. You have to pour the water in the basin and whatnot. Break it down to the component parts until she can master each component part before putting them all together into a bigger thing. So really, you're just aiding independence, just like you would with any child.
Okay.
You know, she wants to do it for herself.
Yeah. She just before our chat, she washed her hands by herself, and she was so happy to do it by herself.
Oh yeah. So adapt the environment as much as you can to support that independence. That's what it's all about.
Okay.
No one wants to be reminded that they're in a wheelchair. You know, they want to access the world.
Okay. Thanks. And I know that experience includes social interactions. Social interaction dramatically influences brain development. Can you talk about serve and return?
Yeah, so serve and return is a great way to describe that social interaction that happens. It's, you know, like a tennis game, right? Serve and return. But what happens is the child will serve to us. And you can see this in babies all the time. They'll give us a little serve. They'll be like, hey, will you interact with me? So they might do something like, ba, 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 right? You see, they're so cute, right? And then most adults will look at them, we'll just be like, ba, 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 until we return to them what they're serving. So we take what they give us, and then we give back something that's the right level for them. And it's not just a direct initiation like that. We may notice them serving, and the serve goes like out of the court. Like, they're just like, I love, you know, I don't know, something, water. I'm all about water, and they're splashing water everywhere all the time, right? And so we say, okay, our return would be to help them do things in water, right? That don't, you know, trash our house, right? So we find ways for them to return. So that's really what serve and return. We pay attention to the child and we return what they give us so that we can really support their social development and their, you know, overall development.
Okay. And executive function development is intertwined with emotional development. Can you expand a little bit on that, please?
Yeah, so emotions, this is great because emotions are actually an essential part of learning. They're not, we all think, a lot of us think, oh, I have to keep my emotions out of learning if I'm going to learn. But we actually learn a lot better when the subject has meaning for us, right? And you can look to Mary Helen Immordino's Yang's work on that. It's fascinating. When we think about executive functions, one aspect of executive function is self-regulation, right? That's part of inhibitory control and it's foundational. Adele Diamond talks about self-regulation being both inhibiting and promoting. So we're going to inhibit unskillful and we're going to promote skillful or, you know, motivational, cognitive arousal, those kinds of things. So emotional regulation isn't about tamping down or pushing back. It's about re-guiding our attention, right? So that we can encourage the skillful and, you know, discourage the unskillful things that get in our way. But we shouldn't try to take emotion out of learning. Emotion matters. Emotion is part of humanity. It's part of existence. And noticing what's actually happening with it is really the most important thing. Because then once you notice, that's your saliency network. And then you can start to put your executive in there, decide if you want to go down that path or not.
Mm-hmm. And I think our big job in our classroom is to notice the positive, even when it's hard and...
Yeah. Overlook as much as you can. You know, if there's no blood, right? If it's not, I always say, if it's not damaging, destructive, or demeaning, overlook it. Pay attention to it. Don't pretend it didn't happen, but don't dive right in, right? Mm. You don't have to intervene at that moment. Instead, you can think about what's going on in the bigger picture and plan your next steps accordingly.
Okay. And what do you mean by Montessori method equals the learning sciences?
So I think a big challenge for the Montessori movement is that it has historically been treated as a guru movement. So we've kind of held Maria Montessori up on this, you know, pedestal and like, oh, it was all Dr. Montessori, right? And that's not really what her movement was. That's not what she was about. She was about a scientific pedagogy, okay? So when I say Montessori equals learning sciences, it's literally because Montessori is a scientific approach to human development. It's a scientific pedagogy. So it's not static. It's evolving and it adjusts for each child, right? It's individualized for each child. So the method is based in scientific observation and then the scientific and scientific method. And so that's what it should be called, scientific pedagogy. That's what you're
So you're saying that when we talk about Montessori, we are actually talking about evidence-based education?
Exactly.
Okay. And I'm wondering, are you involved with government efforts to reform education?
Not directly at the moment. I do support, my sister works at the U.S. Department of Education, and so we do, you know, have sister conversations about these things. So I'm indirect with my sister and then indirect through other people, but not directly at the moment.
Okay. And I will end this amazing interview by asking you the usual three questions. Do you want to share a quote about education, obviously?
Well, I love quotes and I do have one from Maria that I really love. Let me find it. Here it is. Courage, my dear, courage. You are a new man that must adapt to this new world. Go on triumphantly. I am here to help you.
Ah, oh, great.
I love that one. But I have to tell you, I have one other that I really wanted to share, and it's from the Dalai Lama. And it's, quote, if you think you are too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito.
Okay. And do you have a book to share with my listeners?
The books that I would recommend for reading would be The London Lectures by Dr. Montessori. Those are her 1946 lectures that she gave in London as part of her training course. They are so powerful. It was near the end of her life after she had done so much work. So she really put all of her teachings together, all of her experience into one book. And then also Muriel Dwyer, who was a teacher trainer in London and in Africa, She wrote this book called A Path for the Exploration of Any Language, Leading to Reading and Writing and Reading. And it basically takes the Montessori approach to early literacy development and boils it down into some very accessible and tangible concepts that people can use.
Oh, great. Fantastic. And the last question, what has brought you a lot of joy or anger lately?
Well, I'm really happy at being asked, now that COVID was kind of waning, I don't know what's happening now, that people are having conferences and getting out together. And I've been asked to support a lot of schools again and give talks and conferences and workshops. And I'm very excited about that work. I'm glad. And I'm amazed at the resiliency in the schools and the determination to serve the needs of the child, even in the midst of this really unprecedented time. And then I will say that we have a new puppy, and the puppy is making me very happy.
It was a really good opportunity to talk to you today, Julia. I hope my listeners will realize it and will be grateful for the time you have given us. It was really helpful.
Oh, well, thanks, Céline. It was lovely being here with you.
Si ce podcast vous a plu, je vous rappelle que je compte sur vous pour laisser un commentaire sur votre plateforme d'écoute et une note de 5 étoiles si vous êtes sur Apple Podcast. C'est la meilleure solution pour donner de la visibilité au podcast et contribuer vous aussi à cette révolution éducative. Et n'hésitez pas à partager les épisodes qui vous plaisent. À la semaine prochaine !